It is only a coincidence that we got a discussion about America's culture war scheduled for the day of the special Senate election in Alabama. The culture wars in America have been going on for a long time now and figure to continue for a while longer. At the center of those culture wars, sex. That is the theme of R. Marie Griffith's recent book, Moral Combat, subtitled How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. We have to think about issues ranging from abortion to same-sex marriage. Sex and disagreements about its liberties and teachings are at the heart of them all. R. Marie Griffith works at the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis. The center is named for the former Missouri senator, and Marie is, in fact, the John C. Danforth Distinguished Professor at WashU. She's the author of two previous books and the co-editor of three others. R. Marie Griffith, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
Just at the outset, I see some time parallels here. Did issues of sex and sexuality arise with women getting the right to vote in America?
Absolutely. In fact, that's why I start the book in the teens, because it was sort of the height, of course, of the women's suffrage movement. And although now we sort of think of Americans as mostly being in favor of women's suffrage, or we just, you know, don't think about it all that much as being a controversial issue, at the time, there was a lot of animated opposition to women's suffrage. And when women did receive the right to vote in 1920, it really sort of animated this fierce resistance to women's rights more generally.
You know, I forget sometimes the great span of time, and you remind us in the book that the Seneca Falls Convention was in 1848, mm-hmm. and women got the right to vote in 1920. And I didn't realize that Grover Cleveland himself, one of the former presidents, had weighed in on women's suffrage. And what was his reason about not wanting it?
That's right. Grover Cleveland and many others, they were really afraid that women getting the right to vote would damage their reproductive organs, seriously. It was a real concern that it would sort of de-womanize women in some way. Women would not want to bear children. They wouldn't want to be married and live domestic lives. They would just sort of leave the structure of the family and lead these kind of selfish, decadent lives. It was a sort of low view of women in many ways.
It sounds almost like if you improve the brain, it makes the other organs wither.
Exactly. And of course, you know, despite the fact that that hadn't exactly happened to men, but there were a lot of those kinds of arguments about the sort of damage it would do to women if they got the right to vote.
You start with the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage and the response of some people saying, well, the Supreme Court has turned its backs on Christianity. But as you point out in the book, there's really a split within Christianity here.
That's right. One of the really fascinating things that I found over and over and over again is that this isn't a debate between religious versus secular, which is how oftentimes we think of it today or it gets covered today. It was really a split within the Christian tradition itself. Protestants and Catholics were deeply divided on issues ranging from women's rights through birth control. You know, they've been divided over abortion, same-sex marriage. It's been a battle, in a way, over the soul of Christianity. What does it mean to be a Christian? What is at the heart of the tradition? And that has spilled over, then, into our broader political culture.
Warfare over sex, as you point out, it comes down to fear in three parts. Fear of women's freedom, and I think you've already touched on some of the fear there. Fear of people other than white Protestants in control, and I think that's also pretty clear. But the really interesting one here, well, they're all interesting, but fear of a great nation in decline. And in this century that you cover, and we're talking about from 1920 to now, basically, has it always been one side believing we're becoming a better nation while the other thinks we're going to hell at the exact same time?
Well, you know, that's a great question. In many ways, we all live with this legacy of imagining that America has a destiny. I mean, this goes back to the colonial settlers and the Puritans and later sort of Americans as the nation state was created. This idea that was really articulated quite directly at times, that God had a destiny for America, and it was to stand as a beacon for the world, you know, the city on the hill. And so in many ways, I think Christians across these different ideological versions have believed some version of that at different times. And the fear then has been that if we sin in the wrong way and we go against God, God will retract his blessing and somehow will be a nation in decline. So I would say that both sides, to the extent that these have kind of turned into opposite sides, have really believed that idea and really feared the decline of the nation. But it's been more of a political sort of strategy to describe that, you know, on the side of conservative Christians, for sure.
Well, the title of the book, Moral Combat, obviously is close to mortal combat, but that is how some Christians see it, isn't it? I mean, it really is a fight to the death. I mean, they're willing to lay everything out. I mean, I've talked to people like Shelley Shannon, who shot an abortion doctor in Kansas and firebombed clinics. I mean, she said this is all what you have to do.
That's right. I mean, these are deep, deep issues. And, you know, one reason that an issue such as abortion, for instance, is so politically powerful is, you know, there's no middle ground. It really is seen as kind of a fight for the soul of Christianity and for the soul of the nation. So the stakes are incredibly high, you know, once you see it in those terms.
How did gender politics and racial politics get tied up just in getting women the right to vote in America?
Right. Well, you know, one of the real oppositions to women getting the right to vote, some of the strongest opposition, I should say, came from the Jim Crow South. And part of the reason for that was they didn't want black women to have the right to vote, or black men at that time, for that matter, you know, in the early 20th century. There was so much opposition to imagining racial equality in that period. And really, in some ways, this was a surprise for me to realize how tied together these debates over women's equality and racial equality have been for the past century, and sometimes more than others. But you see it over and over again.
You really do, and there's quite a bit to learn. It's a rather thick book, but a quick read, surprisingly so, with a lot of interesting names that we will get to as we continue our discussion with R. Marie Griffith about Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. Think about many of the cultural issues we still fight about very strongly today, and you can see all the things at the heart of that as well. Back to the Jefferson Exchange with R. Marie Griffith and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the culture wars in America. How much is sex a part of those? Well, a lot, says R. Marie Griffith at Washington University. She's the author of the book Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. You're welcome to join the discussion by phone, 800-838-3760. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Griffith, how do you want to be addressed?
People are welcome to call me Marie.
Okay, thank you for that. The move for birth control, it appears, came close on the heels of women getting the right to vote. Was that very close in time?
It was, yeah. So 1920 is when women get the right to vote, and that really does speed up the birth control movement. It had sort of already been underway, but at that point, it really got very sped up, you know, and by that movement. And by 1930, you had a lot of Protestant groups and Protestant leaders across the country sanctioning birth control for the first time and saying that really married couples ought to have access to birth control, in part because it would help create happier marriages, interestingly enough.
Well, help people understand it, because we lived in a time when birth control has been around and freely available ever since the Griswold versus Connecticut decision in the mm-hmm. 60s. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what was the general thinking back then? It's like if you had a lot of kids, you had a lot of kids?
Yeah, well, I think that was the opposition to birth control was made on several different grounds, but some of them were that, you know, God was the one controlling reproduction, and so, you know, human beings had no right to interfere in this natural process. Margaret Sanger and some of the other leaders of the birth control movement of the time said, you know, this is preposterous. These are scientific realities, and there's no religious reason why people shouldn't be able to control, and you know, how many children they have and how often they have them.
So Margaret Sanger created the group that eventually sort of evolved into Planned Parenthood. I mean, mm-hmm. but where did she come from? What got her thinking about what had not been done up until that time?
You know, Margaret Sanger's background, she was a nurse, actually, and she worked with extremely poor populations in the city of New York, in part in Brooklyn, And what she really saw was how this problem of poverty and women getting pregnant over and over and over again, and babies being born into poverty-stricken households, oftentimes with maybe alcoholic fathers or fathers who couldn't provide for their children, women getting ill just because of so many pregnancies and dying very young. Her own mother had, I believe, something like 13 children and had died at a very young age. So it came from really a sort of public health perspective as much as anything for Sanger.
So when you think about it, it's like, well, okay, it seems like a logical thing to want to get the information out there to other women, but that in itself could get you in trouble with obscenity laws, and that takes us back to the Comstock Law of 1873. What was that about?
Yeah, so Comstock and others of his time was responsible for putting these laws on the books that forbade certain kinds of information from being passed through the mails. It was basically a postal service law as much as anything, and birth control information was included in that, as was sort of fallacious literature and other kinds of things. So through those laws, actually, Anthony Comstock managed to prosecute Margaret Sanger and many others of her time. He died in 1915, though, and that kind of movement began to die down. The censorship laws began to be rescinded to some degree. So there was greater openness by the time of the 1920s, 1930s to really provide medical information about birth control to people. And Sanger was one who helped reframe birth control information as a medical issue, that physicians ought to have access to this information and be able to provide it for their patients.
But it sounds like a very selective sort of censorship with the Comstock Law, because if I read the way it was often interpreted correctly, if you had shipped a bunch of anatomy textbooks through the mail, you could have gotten prosecuted.
Well, exactly. Yeah, there was a lot of leeway, for prosecuting all kinds of things. So anything that just mentioned bodily parts was suspect in many ways. So there was a lot of religious sort of energy behind those laws, for sure.
Was there ever a face-to-face sort of, or at least a, you know, in-the-moment sort of standoff between Margaret Sanger and Mr. Comstock?
Well, there was. Actually, in 1915, Comstock was prosecuting her husband, William Sanger, for publishing some of the literature that Sanger had written about birth control. And at the very end of the trial, he dropped dead in this sort of dramatic, you know, moment. And of course, people read that the way they wanted to, but many sort of read it as Sanger won, you know, over the vanquished Anthony Comstock. So it was quite dramatic in that period.
Did Sanger resist the urge to say that God struck Frank Comstock dead?
I think she did. She probably said it privately. I haven't found that she said it publicly anywhere.
Moral Combat is the book we're talking about, subtitled How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. Our guest is the author, R. Marie Griffith, here on the Jefferson Exchange. What did Margaret Sanger do then to build a coalition in favor of birth control once Comstock was out of the way?
Well, Sanger was really a brilliant organizer. She gathered together a lot of the women's rights activists, the suffragists, men and women, I should say. You know, it wasn't just women agitating for women's rights. There were a lot of men who were part of that movement, too. And in New York, there were really a quite affluent people who were supportive of this cause. She managed to gather them together and persuade them of the value of birth control for married couples. And so a lot of money began to flow into this movement. And I should say, of course, this was a women's rights movement. But as I'm sure your listeners also know, there was a eugenics component to this as well. So the kind of bleak side of this organizing was managing to bring people together who were really wanting to protect the pure white race of Americans against the sort of foreign, dark-skinned immigrants who were coming in droves in America at that time.
Did Margaret Sanger herself see things that way?
Well, to some extent. The degree to which she was a eugenicist has been very contested. It's clear that she had some eugenic tendencies and beliefs, as really most white Americans at that time did across the political spectrum. Folks were very concerned with race, and, you know, again, immigrants to them looked very poor, uneducated, bringing crime to America. There was a lot of sort of belief about that. But her prime motivation was clearly women's rights and sort of agitating for better conditions for the poor. So at her heart, eugenics was not, by any stretch, the driving motivation for her.
Was it difficult? I get the feeling it was, for several decades, just to even be able to bring up the subject, because you didn't talk about birth control and mixed company, it seems.
It was. So for decades, you're right, and you pointed out earlier that it wasn't until Griswold v. Connecticut in 1965 that birth control is really finally, legal everywhere across the country. So prior to that, throughout these decades, it was really the province of doctors whether or not they would distribute this information to their patients. And magazines gradually found sort of subtle ways of advertising different products and different types of methods of birth control. But it was still very much a hidden subject there until really the 1960s.
You talked about Margaret Sanger's skill as an organizer, but I wonder, and I'm trying not to use the word manipulator, but hey, if it's what happened, did she consciously pit one branch of Christianity against another?
Well, she did. And her favorite enemy in all of this was the Catholic Church and the Catholic hierarchy. So I tell a story in the book. In 1921, Sanger was scheduled to give a big public address called Birth Control, Is It Moral? In one of New York's largest venues. And when she got there, the venue had been locked against her, and she wasn't allowed to speak. And the police arrested her. She was taken to jail. And it turned out that this had happened at the request of the Archbishop of New York at the time, Patrick Hayes. This turned into a scandal, and Sanger really used it greatly to her advantage to really analyze the way that the Catholic Church seemed to be quashing free speech and quashing women and not allowing the public discussion of this talk. And part of the story of how Protestants came to accept birth control really came as a part of the larger anti-Catholic animus of that time.
There's a headline that I wish I had copied verbatim out of the New York Times, but it was along the lines of Archbishop orders the arrest of Margaret Sanger.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And it wasn't quite that direct as far as we can tell, but it was very much a part of that. And the police was sort of, in cahoots in many ways with some of the leadership of the time, not just the Catholic hierarchy. There was an Episcopal bishop who was very much opposed to her and several others.
I am struck by how 90-some-odd years later, we're still talking about some of the same things, just with different terminology. Back then, without birth control, the discussion was about compulsory maternity. Mm-hmm. And I hear people on the left talk about the anti-abortion forces as the forced birther movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely true. You know, one of the things that I realize is in writing about this book, I write about different issues at different decades over the past century, moments when they were particularly heated as political issues. But none of these issues have really been fully settled in some way. I mean, we're still debating birth control, the contraceptive mandate. Should corporations be required to provide birth control as part of their health insurance plans? These continue to be deeply divisive, for many people, very painful issues that are by no means have been fully settled.
Yeah, it's a question of not just this happened in our lifetime, but it's happening now in some
exactly.
places and cases. The book is called Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. It's author R. Marie Griffith, she runs the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis. Here's a call from Anne and Eugene. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Marie Griffith.
Thank you. All the major religions I know of, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, are all patriarchal. And what people don't ever acknowledge is that patriarchal means sexist. And by going against birth control and abortion, it's all this thing to keep women preoccupied with pregnancy and child care so that they'll stay in a subordinate position. And right now, today, you have all these white Christians in Alabama voting for a pedophile. I mean, to me, religion is just synonymous with hypocrisy. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. Marie?
Well, I absolutely hear this point and agree with so much of that. I think the response that I would want to give, in addition to what Anne just described, is that these traditions have also spawned a great deal of resistance to those patriarchal norms. Now, a lot of folks may say, well, these traditions can't be redeemed. They're patriarchal to the core. I understand that argument. But I have seen throughout this past century women and men, again, in the Christian tradition, who are trying to retain the teachings of Jesus, for instance. And, you know, so much of what the church has taught about caring for the poor, visiting the prisoner, creating a more just society for all, and to get rid of the sort of patriarchal structures there. So I just want to note that there is a very strong progressive Christian strain in both the Protestant and Catholic sides of the tradition.
And in fact, the next figure we meet in the book after Margaret Sanger is D.H. Lawrence, who raised quite a kerfuffle with his book Lady Chatterley's Lover, which took a long time to get the censorship bonds off of. Lawrence himself was not non-religious. How did he blend his religion with sex?
Oh, D.H. Lawrence is a fascinating figure, and of course no one reads him anymore. We've all heard of Lady Chatterley's Lover. I finally read it for the first time, you know, when I was preparing to write this book. He was fascinating. He was raised in a very, very strict Protestant context in England, and he shucked all that very early on for a much more transcendent sort of spiritual kind of practice of sorts. But it was also very much centered on sex. He had a very strong sense of the sacredness of sex, and sex almost being this divine experience of embodiment, you know, that had to come from God in some way. So he was almost a mystic of sorts, and for that reason, a lot of the Christians around him, such as T.S. Eliot, who was a great critic of D.H. Lawrence, really despised his writing. But for him, Lady Chatterley's Lover was describing an almost sacred bond between Lady Chatterley and Millers, the gamekeeper.
So not just books, obviously, were the subject of censorship, and it sounds like movies were ripe targets right from the start.
Absolutely. So as movies, early on in movie history, there was a lot of salacious stuff that was sort of allowed to pass or that filmmakers were just creating. So very, very quickly, the censors got a hold of the movies, and filmmakers themselves decided that they would try to censor themselves so that they wouldn't be subject to, you know, federal and state laws on censorship. So various organizations were created, and these were very much Catholic and Protestant driven. What could not be shown in film, the sort of restrictions on film, they just about all had to do with sex and flagrantly disobeying marriage norms. Interracial sex and marriage were very much forbidden at that time. So that whole history is also very important.
You just mentioned interracial marriage and interracial sex, or even the suggestion of it. This is underscored a bit in the book. How did Ruth Benedict set that whole situation on fire?
So Ruth Benedict was an anthropologist who came out of Columbia University, and she got into a lot of hot water. I mean, she wasn't a controversial figure at all, but she wrote a pamphlet. Co-wrote a pamphlet during World War II that was really arguing that race was a social construct. It really didn't exist, and therefore races could mix freely. There was no reason to have these anti-miscegenation laws and, you know, other things restricting people from dating or marrying across the color line. And this became an extremely popular pamphlet, but it also garnered tremendous controversy, even in the floors of the Senate and the Congress, when some of the Southern Jim Crow congressmen got a hold of this and said, you know, this was absolutely against God, essentially, and certainly against the nation. So she landed squarely at the center of the debates over interracial sex and marriage.
And all kinds of things got tied up in there, poll taxes
intermarriage,
all those
things. Anti-lynching laws, all kinds of things, mm-hmm. Yeah.
We move on to Alfred Kinsey, you know, of the Kinsey Report and his book on male sexuality in 1948, female sexuality in 1953. I didn't realize he was entomologist first.
Yes, he was. He studied gall wasps. Yes, he was a gall wasp expert.
How much did Kinsey, how pointed was he in his writing about the effects of religion on thinking about sex?
Yeah, Kinsey really hated religion, which I think is important to know. He, too, had been raised in a very strict religious background and had become an atheist as an adult and really felt that, for the most part, he agreed with your caller that religion, you know, was really the oppressive force, bar none. But he also learned that there were a number of religious leaders who were more progressive, who he could reach with his sort of message that Americans were doing all kinds of things they weren't admitting sexually, and that it really didn't do any good to dig your head in the sand about that. You really need to face the facts and then try and deal with people where they were in the world. So it was a quite interesting way of reframing the religious debate around those issues.
And in fact, one of the bigger surprises in the book is that religious leaders wrote reviews and letters praising Kinsey's work.
Exactly. A lot of these leaders were really sick of Victorian norms, and they knew that their parishioners were oftentimes suffering because of the sort of moral strictures on them relating to marriage, you know, and relating to sexual problems, or people not being able to talk about sexual problems within marriage. Kinsey kind of blew the roof off of that when he wrote about both men and women. And there was a clergy response that was very pastoral and saying, this really helps us. We can help our people live happier, more productive lives.
Did tolerance toward homosexuality begin to emerge about that time?
It did. Yeah. Kinsey played a huge role in that, working with clergy who were also beginning to be more tolerant of homosexuality.
All right, a bunch more to talk about with Marie Griffith about her book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. We get a few more minutes with her on the other side of the break. Join us by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Back on The Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're trying to wrap up the culture wars in this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. It's going to take a little longer than the hour. We understand that. But Marie Griffith at Washington University in St. Louis at the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics has written a good history that shows us where things have come in America in her book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. So it's not just a Christian versus secular division, but a Christian versus Christian division in some cases as well. You can join the conversation on The Exchange as we continue, 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. So chapter 5 is called Sex Education in the 60s and the Surging Religious Right. And I have often wondered about the surges on both sides of the culture war. It seems like each side certainly plays a part in creating the other. And in some cases, I you know, you hear people talk about, well, I wouldn't have felt this strongly if it weren't for people coming out so strongly the other way. They radicalized me, in other words, is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. And that was so true in the sex education controversies of the 1960s. So Mary Steichen Calderone and some others were leaders at that time who really felt that the youth of America needed better sex education. Their parents seemed to be not telling them anything about sex. They were very naive, as these leaders saw it. And the public schools could be an important place where scientific information about sex and sexuality could be distributed without any sort of moral edge to it, but just pure scientific and medical information. Well, the other side, the sort of religious folks, very fundamentalist at first, were very resistant to this idea. They said the public schools are the very last place where kids ought to be getting their information about sex. Public schools are secular. They have no interest in morals. And these kinds of conversations need to be happening in churches and with parents and all. So it just became a kerfuffle in school districts around the country. California, Anaheim, of course, close to you all, closer to you than to me, was sort of one of the most famous examples of that. But these controversies really grew all across the country. And each side, as you say, grew more motivated as they felt the other side had become successful.
One of the interesting footnotes about Mary Steichen Calderone, though, is that she did not feel that Planned Parenthood was the right organization for her work. Why?
Well, that's true. She began actually as the medical director of Planned Parenthood, and she was always perfectly friendly to Planned Parenthood. But at that time, Planned Parenthood really didn't have a kind of educational component to it. She felt like it was actually a very sexist organization. It was all run by men, and she didn't really feel fully at home as a leader in that organization. So she broke away and created her own organization, which is still out there, by the way.
I noticed that. SECUS still exists. Yeah.
SECUS still exists. SIECUS for the Sex Information and Education Council of the U.S., which has really continued to focus on providing better education about sex and sexuality issues to people through a variety of means.
It shouldn't surprise anybody that when you start talking about sex education in the 50s and 60s in particular, that somebody's going to link it to communism, which did in fact happen, didn't it?
Exactly. Anyone who wanted to sort of educate folks about sex in schools was labeled a communist, including Calderon herself. And of course, she just resisted this kind of opposition to her. She never understood. She was actually quite conservative in her own life and her own sort of morals and her own values. She really felt that people should be in monogamous marriages and good, solid, stable family relationships. And yet she was treated as this kind of crazy radical for wanting to create these sex education programs in the schools. So it's really ironic that someone really as conformist and ordinary as she was labeled a communist and worse by folks on the other side.
Well, when communism was such a fearsome thing, which it's not the same under-the-bed monster it used to be.
That's right. And there was this fear that communists were sort of infiltrating, institutions like the liberal churches, the mainline churches, that somehow communists were figuring out ways to look ordinary and to look normal. And so that was very fear. People were very afraid that an organization that looked perfectly stable and ordinary could really be harboring these enemies of the state.
It seems like the argument against sex education has remained the same. And of course, I don't know that the argument in favor of it is very different either. But the point being that the argument against is often, well, if you teach kids about sex, they will have more sex.
That's right. And if you teach them how to prevent pregnancy, then, you have just unleashed the forces. I think that really goes to the core of it, that if suddenly you take away the fear of having sex, then all kinds of decadent behavior will ensue and youth will behave irresponsibly and this is a terrible thing. Calderon and others wanted to say, well, this is ridiculous. Youth will behave as they behave. And so we're trying to prevent unwanted pregnancies and venereal disease and all sorts of things that will happen. We're not causing that. We're trying to minimize, these bad behaviors and the effects from them.
Well, which moves us to the subject of abortion, and let us bring in a call here. This is Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Marie Griffith, the author of Moral Combat.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Information, depending on whether you call it the deity, God, or goddess, do you think it would make a difference in the abortion discussion to know that God or goddess their self terminates between 10% and 20% of all known pregnancies?
Oh, right. I have seen that argument too, though, that only God should only God can create abortions.
Well, if God approves by taking out 20% of the known pregnancies, that's a pretty you don't want to be a heretic about it and say God is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Maria. I appreciate your opinions on that.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Grumpy John. Appreciate it.
Sure. Well, I think that would be a belief that people would have that God is in charge, right? So some people believe that God is in charge of all of it. God is in charge of pregnancies. God would be in charge of terminating pregnancies, as you describe. And folks on the other say, this is ridiculous that it's scientific. It has to do with, the sperm and the egg and kind of natural scientific processes. It doesn't have to do with God at all. And, in some ways that's the fundamental divide, or that's one fundamental divide between people and partly why it's so difficult to discuss these issues, because we don't all agree on God's role in the world or even the existence of God.
Well, and then we get further into abortion. The people who don't like abortion, don't want abortion to be legal in this country, make it sound like the Supreme Court decision in Roe versus Wade came out of nowhere. As you go back and look at the historical record, what do you see?
Well, the interesting thing is, if you go back to the late 1960s, you see that the vast majority of Americans supported some reform in the anti-abortion laws. In other words, they really supported people having somewhat greater access to abortion, at least in the very early stages of pregnancy. A huge number of religious people were included in that as well. There's some statistic that 91% of Baptists in Texas supported legal abortion. The Republicans at that time were far more supportive of legal abortion. So there had really been a wave of attempts to loosen abortion restrictions, to allow women to have access to abortion early in their pregnancies. When Roe v. Wade decision, when that came down in 1973, it did shock people across the political spectrum because it was suddenly so sweeping, and no one really had expected a decision as sweeping as Roe v. Wade to suddenly lift, you know, virtually all restrictions on abortion for the first trimester and mostly in the second trimester as well. So, you know, that kind of created all kinds of shockwaves that many later on would say were not good for the movement, that it needed to happen a somewhat different way. But you're absolutely right to say that at that time in 1973, the vast majority of the country, including the majority of Catholics, I should say, actually supported greater liberalization of abortion.
Was the liberalization that the Supreme Court gave more than perhaps they thought should be gotten or would be gotten?
I think that may be. The sort of sweeping nature of that law, you could say, really motivated the anti-abortion side to really mobilize and say this is an absolute catastrophe. You know, the Supreme Court has just allowed for the murder, because they see it as murder, of course, of, you know, countless millions of people, and we have to stop this. This is obviously against God. And gradually that anti-abortion movement really gathered steam, not even so gradually. I mean, throughout the rest of the 1970s, it grew extremely strong. It had begun pretty much with only Catholics as a part of that anti-abortion movement, but they quickly gathered a lot more Protestants and others to be a part of what became a very forceful anti-abortion movement.
Let's talk about two notable names from that struggle, though, Howard Moody and Francis Kissling, and talk about why they're important.
Well, Howard Moody was a Baptist minister, actually originally Southern Baptist from Dallas, Texas, about the most conservative environment you could come from, but who became a real advocate for the poor. He had a parish in New York in Greenwich Village, and was a real advocate for the poor in New York, and what he mostly advocated for were women. He had worked with prostitutes, he worked with victims of sexual violence, and what he discovered, and this is around the late 1960s, is how many women were suffering from botched abortions, women who had been raped and who could do nothing about it. They had to bear these children. The children were born into horrible conditions. And he saw a real need to provide safe access to abortion for women in desperate circumstances. So he actually became the head of a clergy consultation service that referred women to safe abortion providers even before abortion was actually legal, and continued that work after abortion was legalized. Frances Kissling came from a very different background. She was a Catholic. She had briefly been a nun in her life. She'd been a very devout Catholic, but she, too, became an activist, and she's still alive. Moody is dead, but Frances Kissling is still alive and has continued to really advocate for less restrictive abortion laws.
So in today's world, Christians in favor of abortion rights, based on your own research and any one of a number of opinion surveys out there, I mean, is this a very small group or just not a group that's as vocal as the opponents?
Well, you know, one thing we find is that progressive Christians are often very difficult to track. They oftentimes look secular and hold a lot of the same opinions of secular people. So that's one reason why we think of most Christians today as being fiercely anti-abortion. But no, I think you're right. Christians are deeply divided over this issue. Many of them would like to take a more middle ground position than either the extremes, I guess you'd say, of the pro-life and the pro-choice movement allow. You know, at the extremes, it's kind of an all or nothing kind of fight. A lot of folks come out in between and say, well, I'd be willing to accept some restrictions on abortion, but, you know. So Christians are as divided as everybody else on this issue, but there remains a lot of Christian support for what they see as very humane abortion laws.
About 2 minutes left. I want to bring in a call here from David in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Marie Griffith, the author of Moral Combat.
morning. Thank you for the discussion. I grew up in a progressive Christian tradition in Wisconsin. My mother actually worked for an abortion clinic pre-Roe v. Wade in Madison, Wisconsin. And I actually worked with a teen sexuality and counseling clinic there in the early 1970s, providing birth control information and sexual awareness training. I'm curious, it's nearly 50 years ago, what do you see has changed and what is needed in sex education in this country today, particularly in light of the sexual harassment issues nationwide?
All right, great question. Thanks for that, David.
Thanks for that question. And your family background is so interesting. And, of course, that's part of I write about, you know, the folks like you and that background. I see that as so rich. I think that, you know, sex education today, part of the problem that we have is it varies so dramatically from school district to school district, between private schools and public schools, between parochial schools and independent Christian schools and everyone else. So there is no standard. And a lot of folks would like to say there shouldn't be a standard. Communities have the right to give the sort of information that they want. But I certainly think that these issues of justice and of equal treatment and, my gosh, sexual harassment, I'm glad you brought that up, that these issues, students need to be really educated in all of these panoply of issues from very early on about how you treat people and how you live your life in the world.
So finally, Marie, is there a real search for common ground, or do either side, do all the sides sort of do better with fundraising and stirring up troops if they stay angry?
Well, one point I hear over and over again, and this is through my work with the Center on Religion and Politics, is we're all pretty sick of the culture wars. We'd like to find common ground. The real question is, how do we do that? But I think there's a lot of energy and desire to do that if we can only figure out some good strategies for
it. Is it a you go first situation?
It might be, yes. Unfortunately, it might be.
All right. The book is called Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics by R. Marie Griffith. Marie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.